Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minnig.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Behavioral Health Integration. Today, we have a very special guest, Dr. Ryan Paul. Dr. Ryan is the founder and CEO of Holden Fitzgerald. Holden Fitzgerald is a global public health practice specializing in health and pharmacy disparity. Dr. Ryan Paul is an epidemiologist specializing with a focus in infectious disease and pharmacology. He has over 15 years of experience in global public health and pharmacy with a diverse background in managed care and drug channels. In this episode, we will be discussing what really motivated Ryan to get into the epidemiology field, how he all got started with his company, and different ways we can improve the healthcare system, as well as the substance abuse recovery system. I, for one, am truly excited to get this show on the road. So without further ado, let's get started. Well, Dr. Ryan, thank you so much for being on the show, man. I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm glad that we could connect. A little coffee talk on a Saturday morning. Yep. I like it.
There's nothing better, man. So you're from the East Coast right now, right?
I am actually not from the East Coast. I'm actually from the Midwest. I actually grew up in Michigan.
Okay. Yeah.
So my family origin story is the Detroit area. German Jews that came here after World War I. But I actually grew up in northern Michigan. So I actually grew up in a pretty rural area, actually Traverse City, Michigan. So yeah, I grew up in kind of northern Michigan where it was skiing and hiking and outdoor living. I always had a dream as a Midwestern boy to be able to move to the East Coast, yep, be a Manhattan, you know, be a Manhattanite, live on the Upper East Side and be fancy. And so I pursued that for a long time. And that's how I ended up. That's how I ended up in New York originally.
Nice.
And then for the last about decade, I lived between a home in the Tampa Bay area and Manhattan. And then I lived in Westchester County for about the last 5 years until I actually recently moved to Boston about a year ago.
See, I visited Boston one time. I have an uncle who lives in Vermont, and I just love the East Coast. I just love the, I don't know, the old school feel.
Yeah, I mean, I love the architecture. I love New England people.
Yeah.
I think that being a Midwesterner ended up being a little bit difficult for me living in Manhattan and even Westchester County, because I am the guy that will talk to anybody, anywhere, anytime about anything. And I actually, it was interesting. I remember being on the Metro North coming from just Westchester County into the city for one of the first times. We just set up our main headquarters office, and we'll get into this in a sec, but it was Health Clarity was the organization that I owned and sold in July of 2020. But we had a big operation in Manhattan at the time. So I was taking Metro North every single day, south into Grand Central Station. And I had my suit and tie on. I was doing the whole thing. And I was sitting next to this other guy that was dressed up, Wall Street guy. I started talking to him. Right. And he looked at me like I was going to rob him. And I realized that. And I said, I apologize. I didn't mean to interrupt you. And he goes, no, you're clearly not a New Yorker. And I said, no, I'm from the Midwest. And he said, well, you're going to learn really quickly that, you know, we don't talk to each other on the train. We look at our feet when we pass people on the street. So I never could get used to that. I was the guy, and we'll talk a little bit about some of my lived experience, but I was the guy that would post up anywhere. I became, you know, the guy that would talk to anybody anywhere at any time, like I said, about anything. And so I enjoyed that about myself. And so that New York was kind of hard. I think Boston was a little bit different, and definitely New England people are for the most part really friendly. And so I definitely enjoy this part of the country.
Yeah. From what I hear, they're just, again, they could be in your face, blunt, and the classic Midwestern is like Minnesota nice, very passive aggressive mentality.
Yeah, it can be. I think that my personality is quite blunt. Don't know that I was always that way. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that maybe I've taken that luxury as I've gotten older. So, I mean, from a business perspective, and as I'll share a little bit again about, my story, I definitely steamrolled people. So I definitely fit into the New York life in that way that, I would walk in a room and immediately go to, why are we here? And what are we doing? And what are we here to accomplish? So I wasn't the type of person that was into pleasantries at mm-hmm. all, probably to the point where I definitely came off as pompous and impolite. Mm-hmm. I think that that's changed over time, but definitely. There's no doubt that there was a period of time in my life where I definitely fit in Manhattan. That mm-hmm. became something I didn't like about myself as I started to see some significant change in my personal life.
I
think you just, you kind of go through this phase where, you're trying to fit in, you're trying to be somebody that maybe you're ultimately not created to be. And you discover that as you get older and you go through things.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, to start off, I'm just kind of curious, what actually got you into the epidemiology field? What really motivates you to go to school for that?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting. So I grew up in a pharmacy home. My grandfather, Robert Tozier Allen, was a early executive at Eli Lilly in the late 40s, early 50s. He was a pharmacist by trade. There was no PharmD at that time. So he was an RPH. He left and started installing his own pharmacies inside of medical arts buildings because he understood at that time that that was where the captive audience was and mm-hmm. that he could create a really significant clinical program that would close the gap in the care continuum between the relationship between the pharmacy and the prescriber. And so he was one of the first that started installing pharmacies on site at clinics, health centers, hospitals. That grew into a really large chain called the Apothecary Shops that was predated of the Good Neighbor, mm-hmm. Benjamin Franklin, Perry drug world. That ultimately turned into him selling actually to Rite Aid in 2000. I graduated high school in 2000, actually went to Michigan State University for business. And when I got out of college, I went to work for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, first off in sales, but in the pharmacy side of sales in managed care.
Yep.
And I did that for about 6 years. I left Blues, went to work for a pharmacy benefit management company, had a lot of success there, climbed the ladder, became one of their vice presidents, left there, started my own consulting firm, invested actually completely separate. I invested in a company that provided mm-hmm. applied behavioral analysis services to children with autism. So we focused on up to age 7. This was right when Obamacare had passed and managed care organizations, health insurance companies started to be forced to provide benefits for applied behavioral analysis. That organization got really big. I was there for about 3 years, sold my equity and decided to move on, took about a year off and decided that during that time, I really became disenchanted with pharmacy benefit management because mm-hmm. it was always a joke in my home. Pharmacy benefit managers were kind of always the enemy of independent pharmacy, primarily because they were the middleman that was taking margin. They were taking pharmaceutical rebates to give preferential treatment to drugs that they could steer in place on their formularies to make more money, right? So they ended up controlling the industry by the time I had gotten out. And I was a little bit disenchanted. I wanted to do something different. I felt like my value system didn't align with the pharmacy benefit management, managed care, health insurance world that I was in. And so I went to Northwestern to get a master's degree in global health. And at that time, they opened up a health services integrated program where you could also enroll in a doctorate level program in epidemiology. I focused on infectious disease, and because of my pharmacology background, it just made a lot of sense. at that point, I thought I was going to end up working for an NGO or an international organization and doing supply chain logistics, international development for a large not-for-profit in a place like West Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa. And that was really my interest. And then what happened was I saw an opportunity to take and commercialize not-for-profit charitable pharmacies that were being funded through a law that was passed in 1992 through called 340B. So a 340B drug pricing program that gave these types of institutions called covered entities an opportunity to purchase pharmaceutical inventory or virtual inventory at a price that was significantly less. And I had a really strong relationship with private sector health plans all across the country. So I said, let's create a public-private partnership program where we commercialize these pharmacies and drive commercial health plans into these specialty pharmacies that we create that provide a significant uptick in revenue and funding for these organizations so that they can improve their uncompensated and charitable care. That was Health Clarity. That organization got quite big. We were serving about 250,000 patients when I sold that organization in July of 2020. The problem is that with the private equity that was involved, the partners that were involved, again, I found myself in a place where what we were doing was not aligning with my values. I did not know where a lot of that money after it was hitting a covered entity was going. In many cases today, the 340B drug pricing program is quite frankly under attack because $1 billion cottage industry has been created. And we still haven't solved a lot of the problems for the marginalized and vulnerable community that that money was meant to serve. And so I took some time off after I sold that. But yeah, I mean, like epidemiology for me was really kind of a byproduct of a lot of the folks that I was working with had postgraduate degrees, were medical doctors. I wanted to have that level of education and credibility. And really, when I did my dissertation, we were in the middle of Health Clarity was actually in the middle of creating a funding mechanism for Ryan White clinics. Right. Mm-hmm. So I became very interested in what it looked like to help Ryan White clinics take back some of the Part A, B, and 340B dollars that had been being fleeced from their communities by large Fortune 500 companies and by large national not-for-profits that were enriching themselves with dollars that were meant for local patient programs, but were not finding their way to them. And by that time, we had sold Health Clarity, and that kind of program kind of disappeared with that. We kind of pulled back. We didn't sell all of our patient population. We outsourced some of that so that those public health programs could be taken care of while I determined what the next move was. But for me, healthcare became about public health. I am not a proponent of a capitalistic system of healthcare. I 100% believe in universal healthcare coverage. I believe the rest of the world, industrialized nations, do healthcare a lot better than us. People will argue with that all the day long for a million different reasons. But at the end of the day, we are protecting margin. We are protecting Fortune 500 companies that control the healthcare system. I don't know that in my lifetime that we're going to see a huge change. But I knew that with the resources that I had today, that I could make a difference and that I could bring Fortune 500 resources into the public health system that in many cases did not have those types of resources, primarily in rural healthcare. And so that's, you know, really what we set out to do today. There's a difficulty in having a conversation about equity when we still live in a society where there's significant inequality. So for us to identify and try to change social determinants of health, which are a direct contributor to what inequity looks like, we have to focus our efforts on what disparity looks like or the the gap in clinical outcome. And so that range is kind of a broad piece. So if we look at Holden Fitzgerald, that's really about what we're doing in strategy planning, emergency preparedness, market, you know, market chain, supply chain, and the dynamics that go into that. And then the overall design of global public health, both here in North America, as well as in the global South. Places like Central and Western Europe, places like Western Western Africa and the Sub-Saharan, Indonesia, the Philippines, New Guinea, places that would be in Southeast Asia, and the places that we're going to basically put together teams to be able to deal with the issues that are not primarily taken care of by the large organizations like Clinton Health Access Initiative, Wellcome Trust. Yep. There's a lot of work that has to be done, primarily in that sixth or seventh level non-governmental organization that's not necessarily getting the support, nor do they have the resources to be able to do it. And so we were able to bring private equity to a table where we're able to give ownership to those not-for-profits, to the programs that we're helping them create, which is not normally the case normally. And I'm very outspoken about it, but if you look at, you know, and again, but just to give you some context, but if you look at organizations like the Gates Foundation, right? On the surface, it looks like they're doing a lot of great work and they are giving a lot of resources to some really great organizations. But if you look at the top three, which is still HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, and then you have neglected tropical diseases, about 20 of them in the global south, the Gates Foundation is pumping money into places where they're looking to access market opportunities for Microsoft. I mean, that's just the reality, right? So the bottom line is that when you look at the McKinsey's, the Boston Consulting Groups, the Deloitte's, the big management consulting firms that make a lot of the decisions for global public health, there is narrative altruism, and that's about it. The reality is can, you know, these, the bottom line is it's about colonialism in global public health. And so we address that in different ways. And much of it for me is on a personal level, it's about activism. It's about having that conversation. And I can only control very little of that, right? Because for us, it's, I'm less concerned about strategic planning and more concerned about implementation and execution of a strategy that already exists, meaning we ask a lot of questions as epidemiologists, and we already know most of the answers, but we keep it science level. We keep it academic, and therefore there is nobody out there to roll up their sleeves and dig a fucking ditch, as I always say to my team, dig a fucking ditch. And if you're not willing to dig a ditch, then get the fuck off, you know, go find a job where you can be fancy, and that's great because I love an expensive suit and I love to walk into boardrooms and feel important. But at the end of the day, that doesn't solve the problem, right? And so what we're doing to address rural healthcare issues is to empower a different segment of the demographic that currently exists in rural healthcare, empower boards that don't necessarily have the lived experience of the patient population that they're trying to serve. So most of those boards still look like you and me, right? And in many cases, we do not, for whether we grew up rich or grew up poor, we still don't have the lived experience of a demographic that would be considered vulnerable and marginalized, right? So so that's, I mean, that's really kind of in a nutshell, kind of how this wraps up. And a lot of that is informed by my lived experience prior to what I was doing, because I spent many years extracting from the healthcare system, right? It's what you do. That's how you play the game in a capitalistic healthcare system. I was taught that, I was raised that way. And substance use assessment access through our exam rooms at our Well Life pharmacies, and what we're doing with community mental health in rural areas where you cannot get a psychiatrist. You certainly fucking can't get a master's level LADC in those areas. And so you have a lot of like, hey, I just got my year chip and I became a certified recovery coach. And I'm in the middle of a relapse while I'm telling you, coaching you on how to live your life sober. Like that's what the addiction treatment world is. That's what it is. And it's complete bullshit. So I'm very, very passionate about that as well, because I've lived it. I am, as far as AA is concerned, I would be considered a chronic relapser, but I can talk about the fact that I had 9 years, 7 years, and 3 years of non-use until I got a hold of a spirituality that came through a psychedelic experience. Then I ended up back in rehab. And the 12 steps for me looks very, very different than it does for most people. The 12 steps is a very mystical thing, but it has very specific application that I think was very, very interesting as it relates to who Bill W. and Dr. Bob was, that we continue to deny. In the program. And so I am a really strong, so this is the way I put my AA experience. I believe the set aside prayer wraps it up. The set aside prayer says, "Dear God, please set aside everything that I know about myself, my disease, the big book, the 12 steps, the program, and the fellowship," meaning that the fellowship doesn't mean shit if we're not dealing with ourselves, our disease, understanding the big book, working the 12 step, and being understanding of what the program is. The interesting part is that, and I just wrote about this on the Big Book Compendium, and it has been a nightmare of a debate going on for like the last 2 weeks, is that what we forget to understand is that page 45 is very specific that we, in our third step process, that we seek out a power greater than ourselves. The problem is that the semantics of understanding who God is completely incorrect. It's about an experience with God, because as soon as we understand who God is now not big enough to be able to solve the problem of a real alcoholic. And so what's happened with Alcoholics Anonymous over the years is you've had a lot of people that have had a spiritual experience in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but they are not real alcoholics. They are individuals that have a moderate or heavy drinking problem that has landed them in some situations that are uncomfortable, that have hurt their life, but they do not know what it means to not be able to stay stopped. So we start to say stupid shit like, don't pick up the first drink, meeting makers make it. And that was never the point, because if you go even deeper into the big book in page 65, it says the very thing that you're searching for in a power greater than yourself, as a person that's self-centered, self-seeking, and the very poster child of a self-will run riot, interestingly enough, you find that God, what it says is deep within yourself. Right.
Yep.
So it actually exposes the idea that this externality of God is absolutely incorrect. And so through psychedelic experience, we're actually set up to be able to see things that our brain would not normally be able to see. And then we all of a sudden start to realize that our motivations, our ambitions, our philosophies, our ideas of a religion, which religion just in Latin means to reconnect. It has nothing to do with the ritualistic dogma or theology or doctrine. And so I believe that a reformation is coming, because I think that what's happened is that we have forgot about the letter to Al that Bill W. wrote, where he said, "Yeah, I'm fucking sober. I'm not drinking, but my emotional sobriety is fucked."
Yes.
Right. I even at this point, as the founder of AA, do not understand the context of what it looks like to be able to write what I believe that this higher source, that this creative wisdom, that the universe gave me to write. And so as that being kind of a collective understanding, we still say shit like, if you are not a real alcoholic that has a problem with alcohol, there's another program for you. It's called Narcotics Anonymous. So we say stupid shit like that.
Oh yeah.
But that would be like saying that we believe in revelation, because we actually believe that John, when he was banned to the island of Patmos, wasn't having a starvation, dehydration, hallucination, that he was actually hearing from God. And so when we start to take things outside of a narrative and start to interpret those things literally, what happens is we start to create dogma, doctrine, and theology that puts God in a box. And then we start to take the 12 traditions, which were suggestions, and then we forget the fact that the only requirement for Alcoholics Anonymous is a desire to stop drinking. And then we make Alcoholics Anonymous a lot smaller than it could be, right? Mm-hmm. It's no different than what I tell, I am a Jew by choice. My mother was not Jewish, right? My father was born Jewish. I didn't know that I was Jewish until my 20s. I found out that my last name is spelled incorrectly. L-I-A-B-E-N-O-W is the Protestant version. It's actually L-I-E-B-E-N-A-U. Liebenau internment camp was an actual place where my people were scooped up in a village called Liebenau in southern Saxony, Germany, and put in concentration camps. And I was not given the right to choose whether or not I would follow my Jewish heritage. So when I was in my 20s, I went on that discovery. I actually converted in a conservative synagogue, and then I went on this journey, right? Because I was trying to figure out exactly who I was. That didn't come until later on in life. The point is that we live in a world today in North America where we cannot solve healthcare problems because we can't solve the idea of equality. We're actually having a fucking conversation about anti-Semitism and racism as it relates to Black and brown people today. We can't get to a place of equity, right? So the idea that we call ourselves health equity experts is incorrect, right? Yeah. That's why we had to change our language. So
yeah, the biggest thing we have to compare to, especially here in Minnesota, is we always hear about like Canada's universal healthcare and the positive qualities it has and whatnot. And
yeah, I think that universal healthcare can be a blessing or a curse, right? I think that it's difficult in the system that we have today to have any type of value-based healthcare without universal healthcare, without a single payer system, right? That does not mean that private institutions cannot manage that system. Yep. But that means that when there are not caps on pharmaceuticals, when there are not caps on medical devices and peripheral medical supplies, when there's not some type of cap, a negotiated cap with some type of medical union, yep, as it relates to everything from primary care to specialty services, we find ourselves in a place where healthcare will continue to be a significant part of our gross domestic product. And no matter what great innovation we throw at it, we can solve micro problems, but we cannot solve the macro issue of the way in which we fund healthcare. I just believe that healthcare is not a privilege, it's a right. And I believe that if health insurance is the way that we access healthcare, whether it's Medicaid all the way up to a platinum level marketplace plan, that is not a privilege, but that is a right, and that everybody should have access to that. So I believe today in a Medicare for all model. Again, do I think that that's going to happen in my lifetime? You know, we can hope, we can work for those things, we can lobby for those things, we can activate communities, create programs that look very similar to that. But again, politics continue to control something that should not be controlled by either the left or the right. Healthcare should be something that is apolitical. And unfortunately, it can't be in this country, at least not today, in the system that governs it.
Yeah, I know as counselors and therapists right now, it can get a lot into like politics when it comes to reimbursement rates for insurance companies and how much we make. That's why, in my opinion, like that's why a lot of community health facilities are shutting down, is because they don't have the amount of money to, again, keep them running. And a lot of that can actually be political and whatnot too.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, addiction treatment or substance use treatment, that's an interesting thing.
There is some corruption in the addiction field too, where let's say some of the CEOs are not spending their money appropriately. Absolutely, that's going on as well. So
yeah, I mean, I think that fraud, waste, and abuse happens all the time in every industry. Healthcare is no exception to that. The addiction treatment industry is no exception to that. And again, that comes back to, I think, a lot of times lived experience. I think that there is a lot of good intent. And I think that, you know, in especially early on, the addiction treatment industry found a lot of founders that got a lot really quickly. And then things changed, motivations changed, right? Talking to a lot of people in recovery that do own very large addiction treatment programs, PHPs, IOPs, sober living, and all of those things are great. And I think intent, as these things kind of expanded, made sense. But unfortunately, when we need to have both a clinical and a spiritual model operating within these facilities, I think that unfortunately, the conversation is, how is private equity and Wall Street kind of buying up all of it, which creates a problem because now there is an increased amount of financial incentive and pressure on clinicians to do what I say are really three things. Pathologize normal behavior, right? Yep. Which then leads to, quite frankly, lying about the acuteness of a patient or just flat out lying in general.
Of course.
And I think the managed care industry has forced that, because when you look at the amount of time that any clinician from primary care to specialty to addiction treatment, whether it's mental health or substance use treatment, you're forced into justifying patient care all the time. And when somebody needs to continue to be in a situation that's safe for them, you find yourselves saying, yes, no, maybe. But the bottom line is that we're gonna fight for this patient to stay in this level of care. And we find ourselves in a place where maybe we have to build very specific canned programs.
Right.
Because now the money guys are saying, how can you scale this? Right. Which I always get fired up about. Mm-hmm. But immediately when you say, how can I scale primarily PHP and IOP programs, you're immediately saying, there is a one size that fits all. We are going to pump people through a factory system, right? Yep. Mm-hmm. So it looks like your CBT and DBT skills. It looks, and you know this, you're a clinical supervisor. That looks like your relapse prevention, and the day is the fucking same every single time, right? It is the same every single time. And I know clinicians get frustrated about it because it says you're getting in the way of us being able to be creative in care with individual programs, because everybody's coming from a different space. So the way in which our program is set up to bill is contradicting, it contradicts dialectical behavior therapy, if that's your foundation of clinical care, because it's kind of like, well, DBT in and of itself says that we can't operate in absolutes. Yet you're absolutely asking us to operate a clinical program in absolutes, right? So I think it's comical in a sense? Yes. But I also think that it's, right, like I said, I don't want to be responsible for that. Now, WellLife, our rural healthcare, primarily on-site pharmacy program, where we're financing the build-out of on-site pharmacies and kind of one-minute clinics, where we are actually providing mental health and addiction treatment assessment referrals so that we can work with community mental health organizations. And we have a great director of community mental health that helps communities that we work in be able to deal with those types of things. But it's a very difficult thing. I mean, social media. I mean, I was just having a conversation with my better half. This guy is like, on my way to go to do an intervention while he's wearing his Ferragamos on a first class seat headed to do an intervention, right? And I'm thinking, this dude is like a CEO of a huge foundation.
Yeah.
And that's just not a good look. Now, I don't care how much money you have, right? I mean, I'm glad. I think, you know, Gabor Mate puts it great. He goes, if you are really good at what you do, then there is no reason why you shouldn't be compensated significantly for that.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. The entire recovery community and the foundation, right, in which we work off of. Now, I believe that there are many paths, right? Mm-hmm. I work a 12-step program. I work an unusual 12-step program, but that's the foundation of my recovery, as you know, and I kind of just threw that out there. But here's the interesting part is that there is no way to detach the addiction treatment industry from a profit motive right now if that's the mentality, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why I always say I don't want to be responsible for that, because I have to balance, right, what we're doing in creating equitable programs and removing disparity or gap in clinical outcomes in what we do, which is primarily infectious disease, chronic disease in many cases, which is opportunistic as a result of infectious disease, and then a handful of rare diseases. And then when you look at what we do overseas, it's, you know, HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, and then neglected tropical diseases in the global south. So we're doing a lot of work with that. But but at the end of the day, if we look at social determinants of health and the key indicators as it relates to how we close that gap, it becomes back to mental health, right? It comes back to quality of life. Right. And if you look at demographics across the United States, we are a sad fucking bunch, right?
Oh yeah.
We are our ambition to pursue the wrong things and believe as opposed to know gets in the way of us having an opportunity to live the life that we could live, right?
Yeah.
So if, as a person in recovery who has gone through residential treatment, who has gone through PHP, and a person of means, right? So, I mean, it wasn't like I walked into a situation. I didn't walk in a situation where I was homeless or I didn't have shelter. I was blessed to not, you know, to be able to walk through a crisis situation with support and resources, which most people do not get. So I recognize the privilege that I had in all of that. But I also know what I look like and I know where I came from. And that's not the majority of America today, right? So how, if the leaders of the addiction treatment industry, right, are preaching an upwardly mobile gospel, right, which is complete bullshit,
right,
and then claim, right, that we work a program of recovery that removes that selfishness, self-centeredness, that self-will run riot. And again, I'm saying all of this under the premise that I don't think that the 12 steps or A or NA is the only way.
Exactly.
It's just not, right? But I can tell you for me, as a person that had right out of high school, 9 years of non-use, mm-hmm. 7 years of non-use, 3 years of non-use. And then after like streaming together 16 years of not using, I was still miserable. Mm-hmm. I had an amazing career. I had 12 years of college that was paid yeah. for, by the way. I didn't have any loans. I mean, I had privilege, right? But I was yeah. miserable. I had everything, right? Mm-hmm. And I won't get into the details of what I had, but the bottom line was I wanted for nothing. And I knew how, and later on, I knew how privileged I was to be able to say that.
Yeah.
But once I truly understood, right, what it was going to take for me to operate in this world as a healthy human being, my mind as an epidemiologist opened up. And I said I had to look it through a lens of first public health,
yep.
then global health, then one health, and then planetary health. And so that's how we've structured Holden Fitzgerald, and that's how we've structured mm-hmm. Well Life, is to be able to tackle public health, which is dealing with policy, local government, how we're taking care of populations in our local community. Global health is how we are taking care of the whole, right? And what resources we're deploying to be able to take issue with things like a pandemic or specific epidemics throughout the world. One mm-hmm. health, how we all interact with each other, right? And then planetary health, how things like climate and resilience, international development, infrastructure mm-hmm. Drives poor health because of a situation where we have social determinants of health that are driving inequities, right, throughout the globe and in our backyard as well. And being able to take through a big macro lens to then say, okay, what issues are we specifically going to look for to be able to deal with? So if we go back to behavioral health,
right,
and what, you know, kind of what your focus is, then I have to then say, this is about the lived experience of an individual right. that then turns into a chronic disease, a rare disease.
Yeah.
I know that in particular counties, why a particular minority population has type 2 diabetes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because they're not taking care of their health. It's because they don't have access, right?
Right.
And so we talk about, right, we talk about cheaper insulin, right?
Uh-huh.
Which that's easy, right? I mean, quite frankly, we were just joking about it. Mark Cuban, who I love, right?
Yes.
I do.
Yes.
But he just came out with the new drug, cost plus drug
drugs.
Company.
Yep.
Right. But here's the thing. If we use not-for-profit systems that are focused on public yeah. sector and social programs and charitable pharmacy, they just came out and said, hey, we're going to be able to produce X supply at X dosage for $170. And I went to my team and I said, what are we doing it for right now? $90.
Okay.
So don't tell me that like if we're already doing it for 50% less that you're solving
yeah.
a problem, because you're solving a problem for employed middle upper class people, right? And you're not even yeah. solving a problem for them in most cases. You're solving a problem for the rich owner that just doesn't want to pay that much for health insurance, right?
Yeah.
And so although we do need to solve those problems, because healthcare doesn't have to be expensive as it is, we are focused on the wrong thing, right? Yeah. We are focused on the wrong thing. We do not need to solve problems for guys like you and me in the healthcare space.
Right.
We do not have a problem paying $75 in cash on Teladoc,
yep.
right? To have them call in a $25 script because Ryan got the flu and an upper respiratory infection and no bivalent vaccine that I had taken in the flu vaccine. I mean, I am,
yeah.
As an epidemiologist, I am vaxxed to the max because I'm wearing masks in public still. I mean, I believe in those things.
Yep.
It just wasn't going to keep me. I still got sick. Right. But there was nothing getting in the way,
yes.
right, of me getting a prescription, right? Because
exactly.
I could just run my credit card and have to put it on my health insurance, right? I could
right.
just get it done. And that is not the majority of America. The majority of America has got $2,000-$3,000 deductible, a $4,000-$10,000 out of pocket maximum per year, and they don't have $1,000 in their savings account, right?
Yeah.
So it's stupidity at the highest level. Healthcare is not that expensive. It is that expensive because we have every healthcare system that exists in the known world operating in the United States. We've got underinsured, uninsured, public payer, partial public payer, private, partial private, right? Seven different systems. We've got TRICARE, we've got VA, and they operate differently. You've got Medicaid that's operating differently than Medicare, right? You've got some private health insurance companies that are partially subsidized, which is quite frankly extracting money from the system by way of Medicare Advantage, right? Medicare Part D, Blues, United, Cigna, Aetna, Humana on the managed care side, and then Express Scripts, CVS, Caremark, Optum on the pharmacy side.
Well, everyone, that does it for part one with Dr. Ryan Paul. I again just want to thank him for being an awesome guest, and please stay tuned for part two. I just want to thank all of my listeners for your support, and just to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. And if anyone has any further questions for me, you can reach me at my email address, behaviorhealthintegration121@gmail.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn at Jacob Minig, where you will find more educational posts on psychotherapy, trauma, and addiction. And finally, you can follow me on my website, which is behaviorhealthintegration.org. I also want to inform everyone that there is a great new device out there called Comigo. It's a breathing device meant to control and manage your breathing rates and the depth of your breathing as you inhale and exhale to, again, help relieve any type of anxiety and stress-like symptoms. And if you do put the BHI podcast into the promo code, you get $30 off this amazing device. It is a once-in-a-lifetime deal, and you will not be disappointed. All right, everyone, until next time, have a good day. Bye.